Okay, let's go ahead and get started. I wonder... Does anyone know what the current version of Google Chrome is? Yeah, definitely not that one. 29. Nice.
The Windows version came out with like a weird button.
A what button?
It has a weird new button.
Apps. Apps on board, yeah.
Brand new.
So it installs it into your taskbar.
That's not so good.
And next year they're killing plugins.
Well, that's not... That's actually pretty good.
Okay, so... What I wanted to talk about today was the stuff that was covered in the tutorial. Seemed like most of you got through it okay. Some of you had some problems, but I wasn't really sure that you all knew quite what was going on. So before I start kind of babbling on about what I was interpreting, I was wondering if you all had questions. Because this is all very important stuff. So, thoughts? That was it making sense, the tutorial, or not, or... Yeah, okay. So, in that context, let's ask a question I did not address in the tutorial, which is, where's the cookie? What is a cookie? Where is the cookie? What are you talking about when people talk about web cookies? It's a web application, right? So is it only in the browser? Well, you say it's in the browser. Okay, yes, there's some part of it in the browser, right? But what is a cookie? Any ideas?
A little text file that stores some information that the site can use to keep settings for use on your shopping cart or something.
So it's a text file. It's blob of information. It's not quite a file, because the name's kind of funny. It's sort of there, but it's a cookie.
basically, it leaves information on the user side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you communicate with the server, it can fetch that cookie and know information about you. So that, for example, a certain account and you click like remember me, you would store like your username and password information on your site.
It's all basically true, but it isn't quite what I'm getting at. Well, let me try a different direction. Let's think of this from the server side, because this is a web app, so there's a client and there's a server. So let's think of the context of your Node application. What utility is a cookie to the server, the server developer?
It's so you know what session that client is connecting to.
So it knows what session. So one of the things, so remember what the HTTP protocol looks like. It's GET or POSTS. Remember we go, let's see, does this have a network tab? It does, yes, because this is an older version, but it's still there. And you see these... Let's go to another web. Let's go to my website. I know that's really simple. So, my homepage, we'll go here, developer tools. So now here, the network, I'll just reload this. Okay, so... What do we have here is we have these gets. Well, that's not what I wanted. Headers. So you talk about these headers. What this is talking about is the request and the response coming back. Because this is the part that isn't what actually you want. It's not the page, but it's the metadata associated with it. So you'll notice that when we sent this request, we said get/soma. HTTP 1.1, host, because there's connection, cache control, cookie things, and then
That's actually interesting. I didn't realize there was a cookie on my page.
We'll talk about why I would or would not know about that in a second. But so you see, these are the headers, and then here's the response. And so notice that there is no, like, the main part of this message, all this stuff is more description of what the machine is like, the character set you're willing to take and stuff. But the big thing here is this get request. Can you all see, you might not be able to see that quite in the background. Let me see, in the back there, let me see if, I don't think I can make this, you know, I can make that bigger, but I can't make this bigger. But here it says, you know, get tilde soma. Now, if I do that same request from 10 different web browsers, the server will see that as 10 completely separate requests. If I do 10 requests from this browser, they potentially are seen as 10 completely different requests. Unless I give the server some way of saying that, oh, these independent requests are all connected together. So what this is saying is, this is, HTTP does not have any notion of state. It is a stateless protocol. Can you name a protocol that's the opposite, that is stateful?
HTTPS.
Yes, it is. That's true. HTTPS is stateful. But anything else you've used in your time here?
Yeah. SSH.
SSH. SSH is kind of more of a classic kind of thing I'm thinking of with a session, in the sense of you connect to the server, you log in, and there is a connection while you are logged in. You type in commands, get back responses, and then when you're finished with the connection, you close the connection. That is not what HTTP is about. There is an open and closed session in the sense of you start a TCP stream. Now, we haven't talked about networking. Have you all learned at all about what TCP versus UDP and stuff? I'm assuming that is too many of you. Can you raise your hand if you know kind of what TCP versus UDP is? Okay, about half. So, for now, although, ask me later, we'll try going, I think, this into more depth as we go in the second half of the class. But for now, let's just take this abstraction of when you connect on the internet, you're in general using connections, TCP-based connections, where you initiate the connection, and then once the connection is initiated, you can send arbitrary numbers of bytes back and forth. And then you close the connection. SSH all takes place inside of one connection. When you load a web page, tens, dozens, hundreds of TCP connections are initiated for each page, depending on how complicated it is. And then, once the page is loaded, in general, those connections are shut down. They're over. And to go to the next page, like you click on a link in my thing so they go to my contact information or something, it starts a new TCP connection. So from the lower level protocol session, you're starting many independent connections to the web server. Yet, you want sometimes for the web server to realize these are all for the same user or from the same browser. So this is in the case of like you have logged into a website. Or even if you haven't logged into a website, maybe they just want to remember what your preferences are on your color scheme or something. And then there's also ad tracking and other things. But they want to keep track of you between these individual page loads. And so what's the strategy for that? How do you keep track of it? I mean, what can the server do to help it keep track of the clients?
Do you have tokens?
Yeah. Exactly. All it does is the server has to give some bit of information that the client will present at a later time. One way to do this is to use a cookie. Another way is to encode information in the URL itself. You can add special, after an ampersand or something, you can add optional characters after this, and that will say, okay, this is what the session identifier is. Or it turns out there are newer ways of doing this. There is client-side storage in HTML5 that lets you store not just a few characters, but megabytes of files potentially on the client side. So there's, don't think of cookies as the only way of doing this. It's one solution. There are different technologies for doing this. Some of them are more common, some of them are kind of arcane. But the idea is you want to store, the server has to store state in the client, in the browser, if the server's ever, and it has to be in such a way that the browser will send that on each request, or send it whenever requested. Because if it doesn't do that, then the server has no way of telling that you're the same user. Think about it. You might say, well, why can't it just look at the network level information? You might have heard of IP addresses and DNS names and stuff. Unique identifiers of your computer on the internet. Well, nowadays, those change all the time. You bring your laptop here, you hook it up to the wireless network here, it's on one IP address. When you go home, it gets another IP address. You go to Starbucks, it's got another IP address. Yet, you'll notice in your web browser, they'll often seem to be, there'll be continuity between those. It won't, doesn't ask you, oh, you've changed your IP address, you better log in again for everything. Sometimes it does. But it doesn't have to. And that's because state has been stored in your browser that's sent when needed. Cookies are just something that the server sets and that it's sent along later. This is why I said it's not a file, because it's always called a cookie. The file is called cookie.txt or something. But it's just a string of various complexity or whatever, and this, the structure of it is opaque to the browser. The browser doesn't do anything with a cookie. It's just stored. And it may just be a unique number. It may have other information. Cookies can be larger or smaller. Same thing with other client-side storage. But the main thing is the server gets it as part of the request, so it can know how to associate it. And so it can do things like associate multiple web requests together into what is commonly called a session. That's when we talk about web sessions. It's saying, like, okay, you're logged in. Or even if you're not logged in, still, this is all coming from the same web browser. So in the context of what you were doing in the tutorial, you can see that this request, we're just adding on new lines to the requests. And you don't actually see the thing where, I'm trying to think, yeah. So cookies, here you can see the cookies. Now, if you're running an application, can you assume that cookie, if you set it on the client and you set a cookie, will it stay set? If the server stores data in the browser, what sort of guarantees does the server have about that data? What could happen? Is it like, okay, I trust the server trusts the browser. It's given it some data. It will definitely give it back, and if it won't give it back, does it have? If it tells it to save it, it will always be saved. It's like a file system. It stores it properly. It doesn't lose data. Does that make sense? No, not at all. The server can't trust anything about what it sends to the client. It just sends stuff to the client, and the client might have said, I don't accept any cookies. Or the client might just erase it randomly. Or it might mangle it. Once you send it to the browser, you don't know what the heck happened. Maybe you've got some crazy user who sits there and starts hand-editing their cookies, changing little values about it, and just seeing what your server does. You see these, some of these look like, these things. Well, what happens if I make that add a 1 to that number? Or add a million to that number? What does the server do? You might say, why would anyone want to do that? Well, servers have been written that are not very careful, and you can do things like, well, I wonder what my friend's email is like. What if I change the I think that's my user ID number. What if I just change it to their user ID number? Can I get their email? Sometimes yes. Because the server... So this gets into one of the key problems with doing sessions in the context of a web application, is that you can't trust the browser, yet you have to kind of trust the browser for certain things if you're actually going to have a unified user experience.
So you're saying you can get, like, password and login information?
No, this is bypassing username and password. Because the classic way that username and passwords are done is you type in your username and password in one form, one page, you do it, hit a submit, the form goes to the server, the server then says, that's the right one, and it sets a cookie. And if that cookie is poorly constructed, like it just says, okay, user 5152 is logged in. So it just says, no, user equals 5152, and that's the cookie. And then now whenever it says user is 5152, it'll do that. Now what if I make it user 5153? Now how does the server know that it's not authorized? It doesn't. Because the only thing it said to the client was the way it knows which user it is by that number. So this is in some sense, you know, very simple and also very painful and painfully hard part of web application programming, is that you don't maintain these sessions, that all these individual web requests are stateless, that you need to bring them together, you need to treat them as one session in some sort of secure way, even though the server, it doesn't always see that. So how do you avoid that? How do you make sure the user doesn't mess with your cookies?
You could encode them in such a way that it's not user-readable?
Exactly. They have to be encoded. Basic rule of thumb. Cookies should look like garbage. They should not have any obvious syntax. They should not, or at least, certainly the numbers should not be some sequential thing or something. If you can hand edit the cookie, you're doing something really dumb. Because it means it doesn't matter how good your initial authentication is, the way you secure a web application is in part by how the web server makes sure you stay logged in. Because you never log in and access only one page. You log in and access many pages, or you make many get and post requests. And they all have to be considered together on the server side. So we'll be talking more about sessions. Maybe for the next assignment. I haven't really decided yet. I'm just trying to decide how fast I can go through this on this stuff. Anyway. So you'll see here there's this request. That was the get for the main one. And then there are also these other ones. CSS, my picture. Can the web server tell the difference between this and so here, I'm just requesting the page. I'm just requesting that image. Here, the image was requested as part of this, of loading this page. The server, however, did not see this as one big request for the page. It saw three requests for these three items. So again, can the server tell the difference between this, just requesting the image in this context, and this?
Yes.
Okay. Another part of how things work. So, you see this? Looks really boring. That's it. Now, let's go back
And let's go here. Actually, wait a second. Well, let's look at this. So this is the request. This is yes. This is what we said, and this is the response. Actually, in general, yes. But I don't know if you can for. That's interesting, though. There's no response headers. Oh, there's a response. Or maybe this is just bad Google Chrome. I can't tell. So, let me explain what you're talking about there in the first place here. Okay, there we go. Let's go to view. Load. Okay, so here, we'll click on this and see if we get a refer. Does anyone see a refer line here or something? I don't see one actually. Which is so what we're talking about here is that the way I got from this page, I got from here and then I clicked a link and then I got to this page. So what you typically see, oh man, it's losing it. You'll sometimes see a line here which says what the referrer of the original page was. So the classic use of this, now this is going to be a little scary. I'm going to go to slash dot. Okay, so now you'll see all kinds of things. So now if I go over to here, so now I've clicked on this website. And I've got all kinds of things that are loaded. So this just gives you an idea. When I said lots of each of these individual things. Okay, I'm just going to leave that thing. I guess the sound in this room works. I didn't know that. We all try another link here. Let's try something else here. Okay, let's see. Okay. So we go over to this one. Okay, John McAfee. That seems kind of reasonable. But that's, no, I don't want a slash dot link. I want another link to another. Yeah. Okay, there we go. Oh, yes, let's go visit. Okay. There we go. I think that one's a little better here.
Is that from the cookies?
So now, that's just the page is just playing, flash stuff. We should talk about what flash is. But so, where is our initial? Okay, that's all. Okay, where is the cross domain? Okay, I'm trying to figure out where the main web page is. I really am not sure where the main web page button is. No, there's a movie down there. Oh, I think you're right. It's.
You see at the bottom the toolbar? You can filter by document size.
Oh, I see. Okay, handshake, push about, fast button, like. I don't even know. I don't think there's. Why is there not a? There's an interesting. There doesn't seem to be a name page. But you know, like one thing you notice is that the page is still. Something. Things are still going on. That the page isn't quiet. So. Okay, there's a couple of things to talk about here. First, you'll notice how things keep changing. It's not staying quiet. What does that mean when you see things changing while the page is loaded? What's happening?
is the page, as the page finished loading, is it still like, oh, it hasn't finished loading all the way?
Is it an app or something talking back to the server?
So at a base level, what's happening is there is code on this web page that is sending requests asynchronously in the background. It keeps updating the page, even when the user does nothing. Well, it doesn't technically actually have to update the page at all. It doesn't have to make any change to the visual appearance of the page. All there is there's code running on the page that is talking to the server. And because we are watching the network, we are seeing these GET requests. And
has it stopped? Has it stopped making those? Oh, look at that. 10 of 2,188 requests.
2,260. 2,203.
Downloading
25
megs
or something. No, what it's saying is the it says 8.14K of 27 megs, 27.95 megs, 28 megs. Does this look like a document? This is a program. This is a program. This is running client-side JavaScript. Let's contrast this with my web page. Two requests. This page stays the same. This is what the web was originally designed to do. This is what the web does now. This is why I wanted to teach this course as web applications, as opposed to teaching the web. The web is that old stuff. Web applications is this. Yet every web page we visit now is much more this than this. What I was hoping to show you here is just that. Okay, let's see. Okay, so this shows you nicely here. This is like these are the URLs that are being sent out. Why did it go away? Well, probably because it stopped loading. Can you tell what all this is? This is the URL that was accessed.
Client.
Hmm?
It's the video. Sometimes there's sound.
Oh, okay. Oh. Is that why? Oh, the sound. Yeah.
Let's look at the video here. It's Sensodyne. Just look at all this stuff on here. So, but what I was trying to point out is that when you hit here, you see these huge URLs that come up when you highlight these things. Okay, that's not me.
That's someone else. So, is that a cookie?
Now, these are the URLs that are being requested. But these URLs are kind of crazy URLs.
The URL, the domain is acts like apisgoogle.com/, and then it's got this huge big string with ampersands in it and, you know, percent signs and things. And what's going on with that?
Is it an embedded website?
So what it is, so some of this looks like an embedded path.
Like you see http://universityherald.com and then these %3a2f2f. I'm pretty sure 3a is colon and 2f is slash, so that's :// So that's encoding a URL in the URL.
And if you look at, there's various ampersands in there
for separating things. Like there's a @height=20, @annotation=bubble, @hl=something. So rather than think about this from a pure detail point of view, because frankly, I don't understand what this web page is doing. If I really understood what this web page is doing, I'd probably have to study it for a couple of hours, and even then I wouldn't understand it. I mean, I've had PhD students literally go spend, you know, years of their lives trying to understand web pages and trying to understand what they do, and they learn all kinds of crazy things, and they tell you, well, could they do more? Yeah, they could have spent many more years studying it. I mean, this stuff going on is crazy complicated. But the role here, and the pattern of what's happening is actually rather simple. It's that all of these requests are going out to a web application. And when you look at this web page, it's not actually one web application. It's really, the combination of products of multiple web applications all put together on the same page. Like, how do you... Because if you think of them as one web application, what's the Twitter? Let's
look at all the parts of this page. So, consider... So what's on here? There is a advertisement here. There's an advertisement here. There's an advertisement here. There are all these buttons. Do you know behind each of these buttons is JavaScript code? Each of these little buttons is a bit of JavaScript code from Facebook, from Twitter, from Google. This is an RSS feed button, which does it? That just goes to RSS. But see, this is plus.google.com. This is Twitter. This is Facebook. These are not things. These are all JavaScript. If you look at these links, the like buttons, that's code. So you could say the Facebook like mechanism is one web application. The Google Plus One app is a web application. Yet you have interfaces into your app web page here.
And I think what it's showing is that little number beside why it's constantly updating and refreshing is because that little number beside is probably the number of people who have liked that in Facebook, and it's updating live. So if somebody went and updated, that's the speaker again.
Yeah.
So if somebody went and up and liked that somewhere else, that would jump to 47.
Let's do that. I think that'll help. Yeah, so exactly. So this is one reason it has to do this. But so when we talk about web applications, it's a little bit of a funny term. If you're talking from the client side, because nowadays the clients do not see one web application when they visit one page. They're in fact interacting with multiple web applications in the sense of multiple servers running programs that are all presenting their output and taking input from one page. And so each of them, just like your one web application, how does it tell the difference between different requests? Same thing that these have to do, but they're having to distinguish between these little like buttons being... these little like buttons being embedded in millions of web pages across the world, running live. And that's to distinguish them. So how does the server keep track of the state? Each request from each instance of each web page has to be unique. It has to be able to tell each of them apart from each other. That's why these each have crazy URLs. They're all maintained state. So when you talk about cookies as a way of maintaining state, you disable cookies, there's still lots of state that's being passed around. First off, just in the URLs. Because they're crazy URLs. I can't see what the URL is there. See, so what does this say? It says JavaScript boy. I'm calling a function. I don't know what it's doing. Same thing here. That won't even tell me anything. Okay, here. Okay, this Twitter one's a little more honest. It says twitter.com intent tweet original referrer. Okay, so the article's going to... Keeps going. So... Does anyone know another term for
programs calling each other over the network and passing data, calling returns. You know, there's kind of a general programming pattern for that.
Remote procedure call?
Remote procedure calls. These are kind of remote procedure calls happening constantly. Every time you visit a web page, you have code on here that's calling other code there. That code is calling your the code on the web page. They're all RPCs. So I wanted to go through this after the tutorial you had on Friday, because I wanted to give you a little bit of insight into how what we're talking about with our simple web applications connects with the real stuff that's out there, and how the tools that you're learning to use can give you insights into those web applications, but at the same time, don't get too confident. I mean, I just pulled up a random web page and I can't understand it, and it doesn't matter that it's this web page, it's almost any web page. I mean, the web pages that are like my home page that are really simple to understand are the exception. And it's because they're all applications. You need to reverse engineer how they're happening. And they're not applications from one place. There are applications that talk to many. It's not one application. It's somehow one application that has other modules plugged in from other applications that are doing it, that are talking to each other, that will lead to other applications. And the notion of the web being all connected and twisted around and sticky and tangling you up and whatever, that's kind of an app metaphor. So I'm going to pause right here. We'll take a little break for a couple of minutes, and then we'll start up again. Just like 3 or 4 minutes. Okay, let's go ahead and get started again. So when you run your Node program, what inputs and outputs does it have? It's a little bit of a trick question, but what goes when you're thinking of your Node program as a program? What are its inputs? What are its outputs?
Requests and responses.
Requests and responses. So it speaks. It takes all it speaks is HTTP. Now on the back end, it might have some access to files, or it might try talking to a database or something. But otherwise, it's sitting there and talking HTTP. So when it talks HTTP, then it's going to some. Now, when it gets an HTTP request in here, it could have many requests coming from many different web browsers, right? You don't know if your browser. You have an unbounded number of browsers that are each sending HTTP GET requests for the most part here, and our Node process has to deal with these. So logically what happens is a GET request comes in, it's processed, the response is sent out. Now for a classic web server, that is more the case. But Node, actually, the picture is a little bit different. What's weird about how Node handles requests?
It queues them if they take too long.
It queues them if they take too long. So if they kind of. It does do something. You're close, but
non-blocking?
So, yeah, the key idea is non-blocking I.O. So the obvious way to program a web server, and the classic way of doing this, is not to use non-blocking I.O. In general, programmers avoid non-blocking I.O. because it's very confusing. Because what happens, what did I say? What does it mean to block on an I.O. request? Let me first make sure I get my terms right here. What does it mean to block? The context of I.O., that's not what blocking is. Is not a bad thing. It's just something that happens. Yes?
Is it the type of buffering that is happening?
Okay, I'm glad I started with the terminology. Okay, good.
I think it's a state. Block in block state means that process is blocked. It cannot access the CPU.
Right. Partially true. Yes, the blocked has to do with CPU scheduling in the operating system. So if you talk about a running process in an operating system, it can have a couple of states. One state is running. It's got the CPU. It's doing stuff. It's doing active compute. Another is waiting.
What? Ready state.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. What is it again? It's like, don't teach operating systems for a semester and you get these things. So the running state is the process, it's actually doing computation. And then sometimes, well, frequently, the process has to be preempted so another process can run on the CPU. Because you might have 100 processes on your system, but you only have 2 or 4 cores. So they all have to take turns. So the CPU scheduler lets one run for a small amount of time and then knocks it off the CPU and lets another one run for a small amount of time. That's how it appears that you have many programs running at the same time on your computer. They're all being multiplexed or switched between them very quickly on a small number of CPUs. And so when the process, you only have as many processes running in the running state as you have cores. So on a 4-core system, you could have 4 cores in the running state. But you could have any number of processes ready to run. But added to these two states is also the blocked state. And a process is blocked when it is waiting on I.O. That's what it means to be blocked. Waiting on I.O. So input, output. Could be from a disk, could be from the network, could be from the keyboard, mouse, doesn't matter. It's waiting for something to happen. And specifically what the blocked means is that the computation cannot proceed until the condition has happened. So the classic thing for your program is you try to read a file. Your program does an open and then a read from a file. The CPU is much, much faster than your disks. Faster even than solid-state disks, typically. CPUs are quite fast. So the moment you make that request, your program is put into the block state, and the CPU is freed up, so another process in the ready state can switch to the running state. Other processes will run while your program is waiting for the disk to service its request. Whenever the data comes in from the disk, then it will say, oh, the data is ready. And it will switch. It will then mark the process as not being blocked. It will move to ready because the data is ready for it to receive. And then whenever the CPU is free, it will be moved to the running state. From the programmer's point of view, if you're thinking in a single-threaded mentality, you're just thinking, oh, I just read from the disk, and then at the next line of my program, the data was there. But from the computer's point of view, that's not at all what happened. What happened was your program made a request to disk,
went to sleep while the disk request was being serviced. Other programs ran. Then your program was woken back up when the disk request was completed, and you continue with your computation. This isn't, logically, this is an easy way to think about programming. But it is, there's a fundamental inefficiency to it. Can you see what that inefficiency is? So this is saying that, you know, I'm doing some, I have a read statement, something, and then I, you know, so then I do a scan, you know, a scanf or something on my data or something. But the idea is what happens between these two lines. You call this read, and then you think, oh, after the read is completed, and now I can do the scanf. I can access it. But in reality, your program went to sleep and got woken back up. Now, the inefficient part of this is that when you did this, you might have been able to do some other work during this. But you, in the process of making this read, your program gave up the CPU. It said, other ones can run on the CPU. And so the CPU, the operating system, the whole entire system, had to take the overhead of switching over to running another program and then switching back to running yours. And it turns out that is not a trivial cost. That actually can be quite significant, that switching to running another program from switching to running yours. It has to do with, you know, flushing caches and such. But so the idea of Node is you don't do this. This is not the pattern. Whenever you do any sort of I/O call in Node, it returns immediately, and your program continues. That's what it means to do non-blocking I/O. Or another word for it is asynchronous. We say asynchronous I/O or non-blocking I/O. It's the opposite of synchronous. This is synchronous. It means everything has to lock in lockstep, which in practical terms means you make an I/O request, you wait for the I/O request to complete before going on to the next statement. That's not how Node works. Node instead, when you make the I/O request, execution continues to the next line immediately. So you might be going, what? If you look at this, it's supposed to be read data into a buffer B, and then I'm going to do some operation on the buffer. If I go immediately to this line, I have a problem, because the data hasn't been read yet. How can I do any operations on the buffer? This line only makes sense after this is completed. So what does it mean for the read to immediately return? You have to, of course, structure things differently. How do you structure it? Well, there are different ways of doing this in different programming languages. There are things called coroutines and other stuff. But in the case of Node, the basic way you solve this is Node as a callback. This is why we've been talking all about scoping rules and functions as first-class objects and other things. It's to solve the asynchronous I/O problem. Because what we do here is instead of calling the, what we do is we have a read. In Node, you'd have read, you'd say B, and then you'd say callback. And the idea is that you basically say, read this buffer B. You know, maybe some, you know, we'll say some, you know, some stream. Here's a stream I want to read something into, put it into this buffer B, and then call this back. And then call this, this is a callback here. So that means that
do the read request, and when that read request finishes, here is the code to run, encoded in this callback. That function could be explicitly defined and have its own name, or it could be an anonymous function that I defined inline. Doesn't matter. But the main thing to know is the code that is there will not be run now. It will be run at some later time. You don't know when. But it will be run when the data has been read. That's the one thing that it will guarantee. When that read has finished. So instead of your program having this nice sequential kind of flow where this follows this, follows this, follows this, that's not what a node program looks like. It has sequential bits where you'll do this, 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 and then you'll say, oh, this all stuff, that's deferred. And then this, and then execution continues. So you keep setting up these little bits of code for deferred execution, and then those deferred, then periodically this will happen, and then this will start running. Now, in order for this to work right, what you have, node has to get to a, so the only time these deferred things get run is when, in effect, this sequence terminates. You don't want to write a long stretch of sequential code in Node. This is a very bad idea. What you instead want to think of your code in Node is a bunch of small little packets of code that are connected together in arbitrary orders, invoked by a central scheduler. It's really calling these at different times. So the code in app.js completes very quickly. In other words, all the lines of the code, if you look at it, all of it gets called at the very beginning of your program's execution, then finishes. The net result of it running is that it's registered a bunch of these little bits of code, these code fragments. When you set up the routing, what you're really doing is setting up code fragments that are ready to be run when certain conditions are met, such as certain requests. And so then there's the scheduler, which is really just waiting for input. And when that input happens, it then runs these little things until they finish. What if one of your little code fragments decides to run forever? What happens to your node process? Your web process freezes. Nothing else happens. You might have noticed this in your debugger. You notice when you went into the readeval print loop? I don't know if you noticed when you stopped the program. When you hit stop, when you got to a breakpoint and it was stopped, did it take any web requests? Like if you tried pulling up a page, could you pull up a page? It was suspended. And then once you continued, what you were continuing was the scheduler. Then it was ready to catch another event. But if you stop in the side of one of the little bits of code that was, you know, to handle rendering of a specific page, you'll block the entire web process. It's not a full-fledged preemptive multitasking system in operating system parlance, which means that it can't interrupt things. It's all cooperative. So you have to, in your mind, you can't think completely sequentially. You can think of small stretches of code, you can do things sequentially, use your ifs and conditions and stuff, but whatever you do, it has to finish relatively quickly. Because if it doesn't finish relatively quickly, you'll never exit to the scheduler, which is what's going to handle the new incoming requests. You make them too long, you'll actually start dropping connections. Now you might say, this seems a little crazy. Why can't we just start off a new, I mean, have you learned multi-threaded programming yet? How many of you have learned about threads? Okay, some of you. So the idea of a thread is that you could make another copy of your program running in response to some condition. So you could, in principle, start up a thread for every connection from each browser. And each thread would run for as long as it wanted, handle the request, and if it was taking up too much CPU time, it would get interrupted and another thread could run. And you'd have one thread that was always listening for incoming connections. That's actually how a lot of web servers are built. It's called a multi-threaded design. The problem with a multi-threaded design is that you have to deal with scheduling all the threads. It's actually not as efficient. This is a more efficient design because it's very lightweight switching between different contexts. It's all within the process, no interruptions. But the cost of that is it's a bit more complicated to program. So I like trying to teach you guys how to program like this because it makes it very explicit what you're doing and the concurrent nature of what you're trying to program. You can't get away from it. You have to think about that, oh, all these requests are coming in the back of your mind, and so I have to think about each portion of my program dealing with a small little bit of that problem. So how do you structure it if you want to do a big computation in the middle of your node application? How do you make it? I mean, what if I can't just do a short little bit of code? What if I want to do a really long bit of code? That's going to take maybe milliseconds, milliseconds, or maybe even seconds or minutes to run. And it has to run to completion. How do I fit that into this model?
As you get data for, say, the first couple of lines, you start computing on the side and have other variables to store those temporary values.
So what you there's two ways to do it. One is you could divide up your really big computation into small little bits and try to order them so they all fit in here and stuff. Or the other is you don't even try. You just don't do it. What you do is you take that big computation and you put it in a separate program outside of Node. You have it in another process and you talk to it over some sort of IPC channel, or you have it write to a file. You talk to it, I mean, you can do all kinds of things, but have it run completely separately. It's not in your main Node program at all. You might say, oh, that seems kind of limiting. I can't do lots of big computations inside the web server.
Does that have advantages over spawning like a thread to handle it?
So the idea is that you could start a thread inside Node, except Node is very explicitly single-threaded. The reason why it's single-threaded is because you don't have to do all kinds of weird locking issues. If you want concurrency of that kind, you just start up a separate process. The difference between a shared process and a shared thread is threads share memory, so they can mess with each other. A separate process, completely separate address space, you can't mess with it. So logically what you do is you have a big computation, you either start up another process or you communicate with another existing process, send it the work, and let it do its business. When we talk about running a back-end database for a web application, that is one type of compute server, you could say, except that its primary duty is not to do computation, but to store things. And again, it runs in a separate process, either on the same machine or on a separate machine. Same thing with anything else. Now again, you might say, well, how does this scale? Well, actually, this is exactly the model that scales. because by forcing it into a separate process, you can now make it as big or as small as you want, and you don't even have to have it on the same computer. You know, say, no, I've got to do a computation that's, you know, needs to get the response as fast as possible back to the client. Well, you can't have it both ways. If you want it to go back to the client really fast, it's got to be a really small computation. So you can do it in these little bit of time you have, so you don't interrupt your web server. And if it's something that's going to take you more time, well, sorry, it's going to take you more time. You have to do it some other way. Maybe you can pre-compute it. Maybe you can store the results in a table so you can just look it up and then send it as the client needs it. But if you have to do something complicated in response to a web request, it's going to take time. And you can't guarantee how long the response will take. This architecture forces you to realize the performance implications of your choices. Otherwise, you see the problems very quickly by your web application just performing really badly. So in other words, a Linode application, if it's responsive at relatively low loads, it will tend to stay responsive. Because if there are problems, you'll tend to see them at lower levels of load because you'll just start blocking on things because it's busy doing some computation instead of getting the next web request. You haven't divided up the computation in small enough pieces. In a multi-threaded type system, you only start seeing problems when you have too many threads running. So again, don't feel bad if you don't have all this digested. This is all things I'm going to come back to again and again over the course of the semester. But what I wanted to give you a basis of is when you look at Node and you see all those functions sitting around in your application, the reason why those functions are sitting around and you're creating them on the fly is because you're dividing up the computation into these little pieces which are going to be run at different times in response to specific conditions, particularly I/O events. A network request has come in. You give it a little bit of code that will be run in response to that network request. When your code is running in Node, no other code is running. You have complete control of the program. You can do access any variable in principle, anything that's within your scope. And if you decide to sit there and loop forever, you have blocked your web application. It is not doing anything else. So every handler you make, make it short. But the good thing is whenever you say, well, I'm going to go off and do some I/O operation, and that I/O operation could take an arbitrary period of time, Node, the very structure of Node forces you to recognize it because those APIs have callbacks. They don't let you just, those don't just sit there and block. They have a callback for the thing you want to have happen later on, you give it the callback. So this is whenever you're looking at the listen, the configure lines, you see wherever it's defining those functions and passing them off inside of app.js, that's what it's doing. Okay, so what piece of this feels confusing? If you aren't confused about something I've said, I'll be shocked. Probably about half of it at least. Yes? Mm-hmm.
So if you set a callback function and it's going to take time for it to compute and it's only one thread, when does it actually do that?
What I'm saying is if your callback function is going to take a long time to run, you're screwed. Every function you call has to run in a short period of time. If you have to do I/O, there are two things that can cause you to take a lot of time in a program. One is doing lots of computation. The other is doing lots of I/O operations. I/O operations, you're saved from it in the context of Node because your program starts looking really messy because you get callbacks nested inside callbacks and stuff. And while there are programming patterns to mess that up, but basically if you start seeing really far nested callbacks, you're doing something wrong. From an architectural point of view, in terms of making your application responsive. But the other way you can mess things up is by doing lots of computation. And there you just have to realize, don't compute large, you know, complex values in line in your program. Now, when I say complex, I mean it has to be pretty complex. Most, I'm saying, like, don't try changing the encoding of a video in the main loop, you know, in a node function. Don't do something like that. I mean, if you just have to do something a little quick or something, fine. But don't start doing major media transformations or processing large amounts of data or something. You don't do that in the node application. And you arguably want to do that in a completely separate process, which could run Node, it could run any other language you want. And you just communicate with it. Yes?
So the code that, so say you send a chunk of JavaScript to the client to run, does its own computations. Would that technically be considered another program that you'd be communicating to?
Good question. So there's this little, so there's what's known as an event. So one thing you call the scheduling and things is an event loop, which means that the node process waits for an event. When that event happens, it processes the event and then goes on to wait for the next event. To make an event loop work well, each event has to be short, the handling of each event. So these events could be a new incoming network connection, or it could be data coming off the disk, or whatever. When you send code to a browser, the browser has its own event loop. So really, in a modern web application, what you have is there's an event loop here, and there's an event loop in each of these browsers. And you're trying to maintain state across all of this and coordinate. But again, blocking over here has nothing to do with blocking over here. Although if you block in the browser, what will happen is your entire web page freezes from an interface standpoint. Because JavaScript is single threaded in the browser too, so you, now your page is just, okay, it's not responding to mouse clicks. It's not doing anything, it's just frozen. But your web server is still doing fine.
It's a bit unrelated, but what are I feeling the midterm is like going to be lots of theory, like a whole lot.
Is it?
Was the assignment all theory?
No, not exactly. But how can you get a midterm like the assignment?
So the key thing with the assignment is you're having to read and write code on and then answer some conceptual questions. The midterm will be more reading than writing code.
Reading, words, describing what we're reading.
So in other words, I give you some code fragments, and I say, well, you might say, what does that line do? Or if I change this line to this line, what would happen? I'm not going to make you write long functions or anything like that. If I make you write code, it's going to be like one or two lines. But I want you to understand what the program is doing. And the code fragments I will give you will either be identical or similar to code that you have already read and had to interpret. Because you know, most of this assignment one is reading and understanding what that node application is doing. And so on the midterm, I will check to see if you got it.
So would it be correct to say that Node is like the central application in a distributed system that we designed, since it's mostly just passing and receiving messages back and forth between clients, databases, file systems?
It's acting like a dispatcher.
Okay.
Yeah. One model for this in software engineering terms is it's a reactor model, but it's easier to say it's like it's a dispatcher. You're right, because messages come in from here, it does something, it sends a message back. It sends messages this way, things come back. It's constantly routing data. We still have another 5 minutes, right? Yeah. Just be open. I'm just checking to see if my watch is that far off. I've just got 5 minutes. I know. It's 80 minutes, I know. But I'd like some questions from people who haven't been asking questions, because I just need to find it, because I know some of you are just are kind of lost with this, and I'm tempted to go into more and more advanced material if I don't have questions about the basic material, because I assume that you've understood it. So, like, questions of, like, what is that is perfectly acceptable, because if you're thinking it, probably someone else is. Yes?
Can you give us an example of a callback function that read would take, or, like, just any example of callback?
So the classic callback that you see in the context of Node was, remember the very last line of app.js, which was saying it's the listen line. So you notice that listen line had like a port number and a callback function, right? I mean, if you look at that line, it's got a function, and then most of those calls have, you should go back and look through the code to see if this makes sense. You'll see there's some parameters, and then there is a function that you stuck in there, typically anonymous. That's the callback. That function as an argument to another function is a callback. And the idea there is, this logically, the callback code is what you would have in a more sequential, synchronous programming environment. It'd be the code that would happen after the statement. You would call listen, and then you would do some other code afterwards. But here, I don't know when this line will finish. I don't know when it will finish. And so I say, since I don't know when it will finish, I'll just tell you what to do when it finishes. So look at every time a function is passed in as an argument, that's basically a callback.
The same line.
Mm-hmm. But go back to your example. The read here, the callback would do something like call scanf or parse the string or something like that. Something that is dependent upon this finishing before you can run it.
In the listen function, we have a port number saying that port is, for some reason, it's busy or you can't access it. Does the callback still run, or does it not run?
In general, it runs, and then the error handling will happen inside the callback. It depends on the API exactly how the callback's set up, but the general pattern is there's some way to find out whether the operation succeeded or failed based on the arguments sent to the callback. And so in your callback, you can check to see, well, did it succeed or did it fail? Like, for example, if it was a read, you could have one of the things would be, how many bytes were read? You might see, oh, 0 bytes were read, or, you know, something like that. Oh, that didn't work very well. And you could decide. But that you decide that. You do your error handling in the callback, not on the line after the statement. Because if you did it on the line after the statement, well, the operation hasn't completed, so you don't know whether it worked or not. The only place you can do the error handling is in the callback.
So you just throw all everything into the function and let it run.
You're basically saying run it later. It's literally like saying, if I say to you, at some point, you're going to do your assignment. When you do your assignment, you should do your assignment standing on your head. Okay? I'm not telling you now, stand on your head right now. I'm saying, when you do your assignment, stand on your head. Because, you know, synchronous would be, stand on your head, you can't leave class until you all stand on your head. That would be a synchronous command. But asynchronous is, when you finish, when you're home and working on your assignment, stand on your head. The additional blood flow may help you with understanding the assignment.
Okay?